Kopfhörn, Ausgabe Nummer 376. Wir schreiben den 17. August 2017. Mein Gast heute Abend ist Dr. Jeffrey John Kripal. Und Titel der Sendung ist Supernatural. Immer kann man sich mit Skype, also auch mit dem berühmten Cropcom, an der Sendung beteiligen. Links drauf findet man alle auf der Website von CropFM, cropfm.at. In dieser Sendung gibt es einen Newsletter, den kann man gratis abonnieren von der Website von CropFM aus cropfm.at. Dort findet man auch den Link, um mir zu mailen, oder einfach an cropfm@nur.at, und bitte nicht böse sein, wenn ich etwas länger brauche mit der Beantwortung, manchmal brauche ich wirklich sehr lang. Und wenn es das wichtig ist, dann einfach noch einmal schicken. Alle Ausgaben erscheinen als Podcast und sind in einem Archiv als MP3 runterzuladen. Forum betreut von Unarmed und Wingman. Und das Coverbild wieder mal von Matthias Töpfer gestaltet. Sehr schön geworden, wie immer. Und sehr passend. Und mehr von seiner Kunst auf bilderdämmerung.de. Und wem diese Sendung gefällt, bitte weitersagen, verlinken etc. Man kann einzelne Sendungen verlinken. Da findet man die Direktlink-Funktion einfach neben dem Titel im Archiv. Dann geht ein Fenster auf und diese URL kann man dann posten, wo auch immer es passt. Und wer diese Sendung pekuniär unterstützen möchte, freut mich natürlich und ist natürlich auch benötigt, geht über PayPal oder als Überweisung, auch als Flatterer, aber das ist in letzter Zeit eher am absteigenden Ast, kommt mir vor. Spenden-Button findet sich auch auf der Startseite relativ weit oben oder im Archiv, und an dieser Stelle großes Danke an alle, die ihn schon verwendet haben. Ja, und wer von Matthias Bilder nicht genug bekommen kann, so wie ich, der kann sich jetzt an die Wand hängen, CropFM in Farbe und zum an die Wand hängen. Matthias Töpfer hat einige der schönsten Illustrationen der jüngeren Vergangenheit herausgesucht und sie zu einem Kalender verarbeitet. Und es gibt sogar mehrere Formate, auch als Tischkalender. Ja, vielleicht für Die Hard Fans ein nettes Geschenk. Der Bilder aus der Vorstadt der Wirklichkeit, der Kalender von Matthias Töpfer. Ja, und hier geht's gleich weiter mit Dr. Jeffrey Töpfer. oder Jeff Kripal, wie er genannt werden möchte. Autor von Mutants and Mystics, Authors of the Impossible und The Supernatural. Ich habe es gerade gelesen. Absolut großartige Bücher, absolut zu empfehlen. Ja, es ist Englisch. Ist ein Grund, Englisch zu lernen, finde ich. Ich glaube, es gibt da auch keine Übersetzungen noch von diesen Büchern. The Supernatural zusammen mit Whitley Strieber geschrieben. Wirklich neue Impulse für diese ganze, ja, ich sage mal, UFO-Geschichte, die riesig ist, die undurchschaubar ist und unendlich spannend ist. Und ja, jetzt geht's gleich weiter mit Dr. Jeff Kripal und Supernatural. Jeffrey John Kripal, born in 1962. He is the J. Newton Raisa Professor of Philosophy and Religious Thoughts at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He is the author of books like Mutants and Mystics or Authors of the Impossible, as well as numerous other publications, translations and books on the study of comparative erotics and ethics in mystical literature, Asian religions, popular culture and the history of Western esotericism from Gnosticism to New Age religions. In 2016, The Supernatural was released that he co-authored with Whitley Strieber, and that's exactly where we are going to pick off today. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Tarek. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, the fanboys say hello.
Okay. Well, hello back from Houston.
Yeah. So for those who are new to the show, we already did an interview, and it is linked up from the teaser right now, just below the teaser, the show description. It was quite a nice interview with two magicians from Graz, Bernhard and Rudolf, who are reicher and stark. No, it's amazing. I always mess this up. Anyway, today we are talking. I'm very glad that you are on my live show. I'm a bit nervous, I have to say, and I have no idea where to start. You could say I just fell into the wastebasket, and it's. But you know, I'll manage. Don't worry. It's a huge subject that we are talking about today. Of course, it's the numinous. It's the thing that accompanies humanity, it seems, from the start, and we have no idea when this adventure started anyway. And you authored a lot of fascinating books. I named just a few. And The Supernatural is, I think, is it your latest book, or is there another one already out? I think it's your latest book still.
No, it's the latest. Still the latest. It came out not this February, but about a year and a half ago now.
Yeah, February 2016, co-authored with the infamous and amazing writer Whitley Strieber, who had an amazing life and made some amazing experiences. And I have to say, this ping pong that goes on in this book between you and Whitley is just a wonderful read. I can recommend it to everyone. And that's where we're going to pick off. Jeff, you are studying religion, but are you would you say that you are a religious person at all?
I describe myself as deeply religious without a religion.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I'm fascinated by religion and certainly have religious instincts, but I don't sign my name to any particular religious worldview.
But you are interested in these things that so to say induced religions.
Right. I see these sorts of experiences, which most people would frame as paranormal these days, as kind of the early building blocks of what will become religious ideas and religious institutions. But they're, of course, not that at the beginning, and they don't need to be interpreted religiously. They can go in all sorts of other directions, including, you know, very critical perspectives against religious institutions and traditions. So that's why I'm so fascinated by these experiences, is they're so fluid and they're so capable of moving in any one of a number of directions.
Yes, and they are going into a lot of different directions, and it seems that, as you point out, in mutants and mystics, that those directions are culturally influenced to a high degree. So the experiences that people make or made over the millennia is mostly relative to the culture they come from, isn't it?
Right. Not entirely, but largely. I mean, we do, these sorts of experiences are often constructed by previous cultural scripts and stories and images, but they also take apart those narratives and scripts and try to write new ones. So they're both constructed, but they can also deconstruct and attempt new stories and new scripts.
So where to start? Making the cut. I mean, there are a lot of very, very interesting concepts and ideas, some of them new, actually, and some of them very needed in this field. And one of them is making the cut. Can you explain what you mean by that when approaching those topics that a lot of people consider to be toxic anyway? But you do that very, you know, very bravely and very direct. And what does it mean when you say making the cut?
Right. So making the cut is my very colloquial way of translating for the readers something that, you know, we're all taught in graduate school. Those of us who study religion professionally are all encounter something in our graduate training called phenomenology. And essentially what phenomenology is, it's a particular philosophical school that looks at experience very closely and very sympathetically. And one of the first things we're taught is something called bracketing, where the reader or the student brackets out his or her own worldview, his or her own assumptions about what is real and what is possible, so that one can enter the world and experiences that one is attempting to understand and study. So the analogy I often give is when we enter a movie theater and are about to watch a movie, we naturally bracket out all of our assumptions about what is real. We leave those outside in the parking lot, and we enter that movie theater, that dark cave, and we enjoy the movie to the extent we can leave our assumptions and beliefs behind. And then when the movie's over, of course, we can lift that bracketing and walk back out into the hot parking lot or the cold parking lot, whatever it might be. But for the duration of the movie, we've bracketed out, we've made a cut, and we've decided to sympathetically enter the world of the film, of the movie. And that's a lot what studying religion is like. You are always moving out of your own world and into someone else's. And the phrase making the cut is simply my translation of this most basic method, where you bracket out your own assumptions about what's possible so you can take the other person's experience seriously. Which is not to say literally or naively, but seriously and sympathetically.
And of course, you had a very interesting experience yourself. I think now almost 30 years ago, something like that, in India, 1989, I think. And you relate that in this interview, which is about 45 minutes with Bernhard and Rudolf that we did in April this year. So we don't have to repeat it. And I mean, you've told the story a lot of times. But basically, what you encountered there was something that appeared to you like the goddess Kali, yeah?
Well, yeah. I mean, just briefly, I had a kind of a Kundalini awakening, most people would call it, in Calcutta in 1989. And there were not a lot of visual components to the experience. I was asleep. And essentially woke up asleep. My body was paralyzed, but my mind came online, and this weird energy entered the room, or my body, or came out of me, or something. And it did things to me, and resulted in a kind of out-of-body experience, and a sense of a profound store of knowledge or information kind of being downloaded into me. And so I write about that experience again in The Supernatural, not to dwell on it or to focus on it, but simply to say, look, that I've had this sort of experience, and when I hear or listen to Whitley talk about his experiences, I can relate to them and sympathize with him through this single experience that I had back in 1989. But the difference is, of course, Whitley is... Willie's a mutant. He is simply put together differently than the rest of us, certainly than me. And he seems to be open to these experiences in a way that, again, someone like myself can only dream of. But it only takes one such experience to teach you that these things are possible. You don't need more than one. One's enough. And so that's why I talk about it in the book. I'm trying to relate to Whitley's experiences, which were much more significant and in some ways much more extreme.
Now, of course, these kind of experiences are not really discussed in the academic world very much or very seriously, and even in mainstream media. So we know all of that. And another interesting picture that is introduced in the book is explaining the world by controlling what is on the table. So we have this illusion of understanding everything, but we only can hold up this illusion when we leave out a lot of things that we just don't want to have on the table to be explained.
Right. That's an image, actually I got from a Dutch colleague named Wouter Honegraaff, and who was using it to talk about the history of Western esotericism. And I think it applies perfectly well here. This is essentially my critique of any scientific approach to paranormal experiences. I think science works so well because it gets to decide what not to look at. And, of course, it won't look at things it cannot study with the scientific method. It needs to control all the variables, and it needs to be able to measure something, and it needs to be able to replicate whatever it is it controls and measures. And then it makes, of course, predictions and develops hypotheses. The problem with that, when you get to the paranormal materials, is that they don't behave in the laboratory. They will not show up in any kind of robust form. They generally show up in traumatic or dangerous or deadly situations, or purely spontaneous situations that might happen once or twice in a person's life. So there's no reliable way to get them to appear, and they're not objects to measure. They're experiences. They're subjective states that often correlate with some objective event in the environment, but are themselves not objects. So they just don't behave by the scientific method. And so what the material historian and scientist will say is they're simply anecdotal. And that's his or her way of taking them off the table so they don't have to think about them. But that doesn't work for me as a historian or as a scholar of religion, because most profound religious experiences are anecdotal in that precise sense. And these anecdotal events, which happen once maybe in a person or a community's life, end up having tremendous influence on human history and human civilization, and often go on to produce entire religions. So it just doesn't work when you're looking at these sorts of profound, anomalous experiences. And so that's my critique of the table, is we need to put these things back on the table again so we can think about them and embrace them as part of the human experience.
Someone asks in the chat, how can you prove that those phenomena are real? Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, first of all, the experience people make is real to them. That's one thing.
Again, the question presumes the scientific method. It presumes proof. And that's precisely what I'm critiquing, is the whole question is misstated. It's the wrong question. You can't prove these things because you can't get them in a laboratory and you can't measure them and replicate them. But that doesn't mean they don't happen. It doesn't mean they're not part of the world. They're definitely part of our world. They happen all the time. They happen every hour of every day of every month of every year, thousands of times all over the globe. But they don't happen when we force them or want them to happen.
Yeah, they are not reproducible in a laboratory, as you just said. And nevertheless, they are, as you also said, very, very influential on our world. So if anyone says, well, how does that concern me? Well, the whole culture we live in is shaped by religion, is shaped
right
by popular culture. That's not a new phenomenon. There was always popular culture, and apparently popular culture is can deal with those things, just because popular culture doesn't have to be serious. And
well, so Tarek, the other reason they should interest people, regardless of whether they can be proven or not, is that what they suggest is that human beings are far more than we imagine them to be. I mean, what paranormal events suggest is that mind or consciousness does not end at the skin or is not contained just in the brain. These things suggest that mind is not in the brain, but the brain is in mind. It really reverses or flips the entire worldview in which we presently live and offers us something that's far more fantastic and frankly far more interesting and meaningful than the kind of dead, depressing material worldview that so many of us, suffer through today.
Yeah, to quote the book once again, it's not all in the mind, or the mind is not all in us.
That what? Say that again.
It's not all in the mind, or the mind is not all in us. Another quote from the book. Yeah,
yeah, that's that sounds like Whitley.
I think it's from Whitley. So, Kenneth Arnold, UFOs. Let's go bluntly to the subject of UFOs, which is something that captures pop culture and all kinds of strange societies and conspiracy theories. And I mean, this is a huge thing. That's why I said I kind of dropped in the wastebasket trying to find the right approach here, where to start with. Well, we just started now anyway. And it kind of started, I mean, it when did it start? We don't know anyway. But in our new, let's say, when in the 40s or the 50s the whole thing really kicked off, it was the sighting of Kenneth Arnold. And everyone thinks, he saw those discs flying there. And, maybe some even know that they were kind of luminous and they were looking like they were swimming or like a stone that you throw on the water. But what not a lot of people remember, realize, or know is that he described those objects, and this is also written in the Supernatural, that they can change their density and that they probably come from the place we go when we die. Which, right. You know, and that's then, you know, we are not talking about nuts and bolts UFOs here. So the whole thing started off with something, you know, that is numinous.
here's the problem, is that what Arnold actually saw, he himself described as quote-unquote not mechanical at all, that these were living creatures or living beings, and he felt that they were soul-like and that they came from this other world, this where we go and we die. So he had a very occult or spiritual view of the nine glowing, they actually looked like manta rays is what they looked like. They weren't discs. But what happens is that's June of 1947, and then Roswell happens 10 days later, and the whole thing gets grabbed consciously or unconsciously by the U.S. military and the Cold War, and it becomes a myth of paranoia and a myth of invasion from, you know, off-planet. So the whole mythology gets grabbed by the Cold War and just gets run with then through countless movies and books and short stories. And what I try to show, and Whitley's completely with me here, what we both try to show in this book is that was a mistake. That's not actually what a lot of UFO encounters are about. If you look at them closely, they bear all the marks of something spiritual, and the tens of thousands of letters that Ann and Whitley Strieber received after Communion came out, you know, one of the things that Ann said when she went through all of them is that she was convinced that the whole abduction phenomena had something to do with the dead. Because the dead loved ones often show up in abduction experiences. And so she, you know, she essentially came to the same conclusion that Ken Arnold had came to back in his own day. But of course, that all gets elided when we talk, you know, UFO was an acronym that the U.S. Air Force named, and they named it for security reasons. So we're talking about UFOs to this day, and that very expression carries again this Cold War paranoia about invasion, and it's just wrong, and so we essentially have to start over, and that's really what Whitley and I are calling for in this book is to just. Let's just start over. Let's be smarter about it, and let's be more nuanced and more careful, and not fall into all these fundamentalist and military traps, which we have fallen into.
Yeah, and let's let go of the idea that Mr. Spock is coming down in his spaceship and teaches us about warp drives. I mean,
that would be really cool.
Yeah, it would be great, but it's not what happened.
Yeah, let go of that too. I mean, you know, Star Trek actually. I mean, not to dwell on the nerdy stuff, but actually, Star Trek is the opposite of the UFO myth. You know, the UFO myth is about extraterrestrials invading us, and Star Trek is about us, you know, moving into the cosmos and sort of moving out of our little Earth mythologies and getting this much more kind of anthropological view of the universe. And so I think the Star Trek myth is actually a much healthier story to develop than the one that developed with the UFO.
Well, I think there are a lot of stories that developed. I mean, one of them is, as you rightly say, is we are invaded by body snatchers. But I mean, there are other stories out there. I mean, there are brothers from other galaxies, I mean, there are so many stories out there. That's exactly the wastebasket. You know, I mean, it's
endless. True.
So, but there is this, and I understand it, and I for long thought, yeah, it might be the most probable explanation for this whole phenomena, is that some species from another planet, just as physical as we are, traveled through space and time, maybe, you know, whatever, however they traveled, but they did travel, and they are here now, and, you know, they're examining us. I can totally understand that this is a very tempting theory. But
right.
Once, I mean, I'm just reading the Mothman prophecies, and I mean, once you look at those, and I mean, there are many other books. I mean, Jacques Vallée wrote about this and others without this bias to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And once you let go of this bias and just look at what do people really experience, well, then this whole thing falls apart. And then
That's correct.
And then there's the weird sex thing that most people don't even talk about because they're ashamed, and I can understand that. It's already enough to, you know, have weird creatures come into your bedroom at night. But but then there is also this weird sex thing, and if you also accept that as being part of this story, well, then, I mean, if these are extraterrestrials, then I'm really afraid because they are mad.
Yeah, and that's what I meant about controlling the table. You know, once someone lands on the answer for the UFO phenomena, they have to take a lot of things off the table to preserve that particular theory. You know, if it's extraterrestrials invading us from outer space, then they have to take off the table all those people who see their dead loved ones during an abduction event, or they have to take off the table you know, all of the beneficent and ecstatic and gorgeous experiences people have. I mean, so there, any theory you develop has to control the table. And again, what Whitley and I are begging for is for us not to do that, is to just throw everything on the table and let's look at it again and not jump to conclusions and start having to pull things off the table again.
Yeah. And another comment from the chat is, a UFO stops being a UFO as soon as you can explain what it is. Yes, that's the definition of the word. And those UFOs we talk about have not been explained, period. And Mark Pilkington, whom you also know, and that I had the pleasure to interview at the start of this year, actually it was the first show in this year, he pretty much dealt with those nuts and bolt aspects of the phenomena, which are quite earthly, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Mark was looking at, I mean, it's been a while since I dipped into Mirage Men, but Mark was looking at actual cases that were staged or were, you know, were misinformation campaigns, essentially, both by the U.S. military, but also with crop circles, where, you know, people are creating their own crop circles. So, but I think Mark would say that, you know, just because some are fraudulent and some are staged doesn't mean it all is.
No.
And you see, that's what I mean. That's what why I invoke the wastebasket at the beginning of the supernatural is, you know, basically what I say is the UFO phenomena is like a wastebasket, and all this stuff is in there. You've got people waking up in the middle of the night with strange things on top of them. You've got lights seen in the sky. You've got pilots and military people encountering craft in the sky. You've got radar traces. You've got things burned into the ground. You've got disinformation campaigns. You've got people's hoaxing these things, and it's all thrown in the garbage. It's all thrown in there and mixed up. And so the mistake we make is we think all of those things are connected and they're all the same thing.
No.
When in fact they might be all in different things and they might not be connected at all. And so we don't understand the phenomenon because it's all this stuff in the wastebasket.
Yeah, and we try to simplify things, of course. You know, we want to make sense of the world. I mean, if you look at clouds, we see faces because we order things. We leave things out. We have to. I mean, if we would perceive everything that is happening around us, we would go crazy. So we only perceive a tiny fraction of what is happening in this quantum field that we are all engulfed in. So, and that's all fine. But when it comes to this question here, then, as you say, if you throw everything into the wastebasket and then just pick out something,
I think the other thing that the other mistake that is made a lot, and I write about this in the book, is, you know, people always assume the worldview of the present, which they then want to read back into the past. So people assume space travel and extraterrestrials and science fiction today, and so they want to read all ancient myth and all ancient art as somehow, you know, ancient astronauts that are being misperceived as gods or demons in the religious past. But one can flip that. And one can see the entire UFO phenomena as a kind of modern religious phenomena that's being misperceived or misread by naive moderns who are wanting to frame it as, you know, spaceships and astronauts, when in fact these are classical religious experiences. I mean, there's nothing more religious than strange beings coming from the sky and doing weird shit to human beings.
Yeah.
That's what religion is. That's what it's always been. And just because we live in this sort of science fiction technological age doesn't mean that's the answer to all of this. It just means that's another myth. That's another story that human beings have, you know, made up essentially to try to understand their place in the universe.
Yeah. Exactly.
And none of this, Tarek, none of this denies that these profound things happen. I mean, you read the book. You know that both Whitley and I think this is very real, and that these abductions and these encounters are actually happening and are important to think about and understand. But in what sense they're real and what they're actually about, that's the big question. And what we're trying to do in the book is acknowledge and appreciate the fact that these things are happening, but not jumping to this or that quick conclusion. And, you know, Willie's speaking and writing here out of a whole lifetime of these experiences. He's not just thinking off the top of his head. He's thinking out of a whole life of abduction.
30 or 40 years, I mean.
Yeah.
Actually, his whole life, exactly. I mean, we'll talk about Whitley more later on. I mean, he had unbelievable experiences. How this man didn't go crazy, I have no idea. He must be a very strong personality.
I guess I said earlier, he is simply wired differently than the rest of us.
Obviously.
He moves through the world in a radically different way.
One of the most interesting, I mean, all of the chapters in The Supernatural are really fascinating and a great read, but the one that captured me, maybe the one that captured me most, and I just reread it also, is The Soul is a UFO, which is quite a bold statement to make, but,
yeah.
I mean, it does make a lot of sense if you look at it the way you do. This whole concept of the plasmatic soul, intelligent plasma, sensitive plasmas, and making the move from reason to resonance. I mean, this is for me one of the core aspects of the book and of those ideas that you guys bring on the table here.
Yeah, I know. As you started to talk there, I was thinking in my head, okay, he's going to the soul as a UFO chapter. I can tell already. And because that's the piece that catches a lot of people, because it just makes so much intuitive sense to them, I think. You know, the last person who kind of went really, really enthusiastic about that same chapter was Dennis McKenna, who, I don't know if you know Dennis's work, but he and his brother Terrence were very prominent in the 70s and 80s around psychedelics and DMT and ayahuasca and all kinds of sort of psychedelic visionary experiences. And in a lot of these experiences, UFOs show up, particularly flying saucers. And there's a profound sense in that subculture that these are souls. And that's what it's about. So when Dennis read the chapter, he had a kind of aha moment, you know, just like you did. And historically, you know, what I point out in that chapter is that the soul is often described as spherical and as, you know, composed of some kind of alternate energy or life force. And you see that all the way back to the ancient world, back to the ancient Greeks. So,
yeah, and everyone who has seen Babylon 5, the last episode, knows what the soul looks like, doesn't he?
You know, I haven't seen it.
You so. Haven't seen it? Oh. Well, I mean, the first two seasons, yeah, you can leave them out, but... I'm not gonna spoil it for you, but the last episode, the last scene, is exactly that, and it is. When I was sitting there, this was in the 90s, and I read a lot of. I was really into this, and I did make the cut without knowing this expression yet. I read a lot of channelings. I was fascinated by channelings. I mean, I just loved this stuff because I just thought, well, you know, I don't care if this is written by a Syrian or by this Sheldon Neill guy or whoever. It's just part of it, partly brilliant. I mean, some of it was bullshit, but a lot of it was really brilliant. And and then you look at Babylon 5 and they just visualize this, and this goes just great with your notion of the plasmatic soul. And a very interesting point that Whitley brings up is the Condyne report. I looked it up in the meantime, and which is funnily named very similar to the Condon report from the 60s from Colorado University. No one knows why. Well, I don't know why, really. And it confirms that there is a phenomenon of intelligent, or at least it looks intelligent, it behaves as if it would be intelligent, plasma in our skies. It just confirms this in an official UK document, which is astonishing.
Yeah, I know, and that's the kind of thing that never makes it into the media.
No, but it makes it into Crop FM at least. So, it never makes it into the real broad mindset of people. Yeah, and no one knows why. And people, they ask me, well, is it real? You know, like the person just asking in the chat, is there any proof? Well, read the Condyne report. It is. At least those people think it's real, you know. Right. I mean, I've never seen such a thing. I mean, maybe I have seen it, but I haven't seen anything yet that is clearly not a satellite or an airplane or whatever. But a lot of people, they're just haunted by those things, you know. I know some people, they went to Wiltshire, and on the first field, they film a plasma ball flying over the fields there, which happens quite often there. And now this year they've been in Scotland, it's Calibre Trieb, and they make photos of something that looks like a sea monster, but not in Loch Ness, in another sea, in another lake there. But, you know, they just go there and and those things pop up in front of them. So who knows what that is, but it's really funny. Partly. So the Condyne report, did you read the whole?
Oh, heavens, no. Yeah. I read the first few pages where they do give all the conclusions. And a long report. I don't know if you saw it, but it goes on forever.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, I also read the conclusions, and yeah, they pretty much said, yeah, it's there. It's probably not harming us, so don't worry.
Well, again, you know, so my gut sort of position is that these things or this phenomena has been with humanity for millennia, probably farther back than we can see. And if it wanted to do harm, we wouldn't be here. And so I don't think it's sinister. And I also think it's probably us. You know, I think it's probably human in some kind of post-human or transhuman way. I mean, it certainly looks that way. It behaves that way. So I think what's so fascinating about this stuff is not that it leads to, you know, spaceships and warp drives, but that it leads to a kind of new vision of us, what a human being is, and what we're capable of, what we are. And, you know, that's the question Whitley keeps coming back to in the book is, who are we?
Yeah. And where are we and what are we?
Yeah.
That are his questions, and they are absolutely fundamental.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, that was his gut feeling from day one. I mean, he points that out in the book, but if you read Communion, I mean, he offers a lot of possibilities in the book, but, you know, at the end of the day, including on the first page, he really thinks it's us, you know, messing with us. And that's my gut feeling, too.
So UFO's a freaking story that shows up on radar. And
I know. Well, see, this is the thing. You know, when we say us, when we think of souls, we always, I think, assume it doesn't have any material reality. But that's just a modern assumption, Tariq. I mean, the soul often does have a body and often does have material effects, and energy has physical effects. If it's some kind of energy, there's no reason it wouldn't have physical effects in the environment. You'd expect that, right? But we have so gutted any notion of soul or spirit that we can only imagine it as this ephemeral, non-existent nothing that, you know, couldn't show up on radar. But turns out it does.
Yes. And this, I think, I mean, we're already coming already to the gist of it. This is what you and Whitley try to approach in the book, that and also this flip that you describe. So maybe we are the dead, and, you know, those other things are really living, and we I mean, it's quite mind-boggling. But can you elaborate a little bit more on that? When you say it's us, I mean, there is one of the many, many, many theories out there. Now I'm stretching into the wastebasket. Is, yeah, these are time travelers from the future. We are coming back and try to influence us because, you know, there might be some big catastrophe in the future and they come back to avoid this. So I guess that's not what you mean, or?
Well, I don't necessarily mean that. I mean, I think that's of course one possibility. I mean, that's a stretch, but you know, listen, once you go down this rabbit hole, pretty much anything's possible. It's kind of hard to tell where the possibles and the impossible meet. But I mean, what I mean by the phrase, I think it's us, you know, the simple analogy of a dream. We all dream. We've all had a dream. And the basic phenomenology of a dream is that you're having this vision and that you're caught in this story and you don't really have control of it. But somebody does. Somebody's telling that story. Somebody's projecting those images. And, of course, when we wake up, the natural conclusion is that some part of us was telling some other part of us a story and kind of pulling it along. So a part of us didn't seem to have any choice in the matter and was caught in this story, but the other part of us was actually telling the story and was trying to tell this other part of us something about us. So a dream already presumes all kinds of levels of self that are trying to communicate with one another through images and story and all sorts of stuff. And I think UFO encounters often are essentially waking dreams like that, that some part of us is interacting with some other part of us and trying to wake us up or communicate something to us. And, you know, if you read UFO encounters closely enough, they'll often say this. They'll often say, my consciousness shifted. It felt like a dream. Ufologists even talk about the Oz effect, this kind of notion in which reality starts to shift before the UFO appears. So there's something here that is dreamlike and that is clearly staged for a particular viewer. And that's what I'm getting at. I don't mean us as in Tarek or Jeff's doing this, but some deeper, grander part of us is staging these events so that, well, we don't know why. I guess that's kind of the point. Don't you wake up from a dream and say, what the fuck was that about?
Yeah, right? Constantly.
Who was telling that story? Well, you were. Okay, which you? You know, and of course the answer is you don't know. You're unconscious of that aspect of you. Well, I think something like that, not the same thing, but something like that is happening in these abduction accounts. Some part of us is abducting some other part of us to try to wake us up or force us into some kind of realization.
Yeah. Another
one. You know, that's what Jung thought. I don't know.
I just had Jung here. Yeah, Jung, who said the left side of the brain tries to communicate with the right side of the brain, or the other. Yeah, no, this way around.
Yeah, it's the other way around. I mean, basically, what Jung said is that we live in such a materialist, mechanical culture that we become sick, and these other that essentially UFOs are the larger psyche or the larger planetary geist trying to appear to us and wake us up out of this mechanistic nightmare we're in at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the right side of the brain trying to show something to the left side of the brain. I mean, he actually says that it's us trying to tell us something about us.
Right. And Tarek, the other thing I pointed out in the book, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the things I think is really interesting that if you read the neuroanatomy of the right and left hemispheres of the brain, one of the things you discover is that the right hemisphere of the brain, when it looks at a face, it only processes the top half of the head, in other words, the eyes. And the left hemisphere processes the lower half of the face, so the nose and the mouth and the chin. So what you would expect to see if you were looking at a face with only the right hemisphere, or if only the right hemisphere was involved in a visionary experience, what you would expect to see is a human face with immense eyes and almost no mouth or nose.
Oh, isn't that didn't we see that before somewhere?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we get, of course.
Yes.
You know, in these abduction accounts. So I think this notion that some form of mind is beaming through the right hemisphere and is appearing to the ego or the self in the left hemisphere and appearing as this big-eyed, small-mouth, small-nosed humanoid figure. I think this makes a lot of sense.
Actually, and, absolutely, yes. I forgot that completely. Yes, this is... Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Another quote from the book also is, consciousness, a dream constantly guided by sensory input, which is so true.
Right. That's just good old neuroscience again. That
yeah, but it says so much about, I mean, we think we're awake and everything is, you know, we have this illusion that we perceive reality exactly as it is, but I think it is much more a dream that is here and then, you know, there's a little bit of a nudge here and there. Oh, yeah, here's the table, and there, you know, there's a light there. And then we fill in the gaps, but
yep.
We fill in the gaps.
Right.
And the and gaps, we fill in is coming from the culture, is coming from our experience, whatever.
Yeah. And of course, we don't perceive everything that is. As you said earlier, if we did, we'd go crazy.
Yeah.
We'd just be overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, some people do it, open themselves up with drugs, forcefully, so to say, and some don't survive that. And others have great experiences and really, strive. And but also this UFO experience is something like this consciousness expanding experience. You also point out in the book and that many figures, well known, they are that people have those experiences and that they come out on the other end and they are totally changed. I mean, Ronald Reagan, for God's sake, had such an experience, and John Lennon and Frank Zappa and I don't know, David Bowie. I mean, it seems like everyone has seen a UFO except me.
Yeah, me too, Tarek. I'm with you.
Great.
Yeah.
This is, so this consciousness as a dream, and then you get those notches, and then something pops up, and even the concept of illumination could be, John Keel describes it, that illumination might just be this beam of light. There is this classic, even in the X-Files, you have this, there is this one scene where this triangle is above his head and this beam of light shines down to him. And this is a very, very strong picture that is repeated again and again and again.
Yep.
What is it?
And it's religious.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you even have some religious pictures that show something like that. I don't know if it's that, but it looks like that. You see some heads flying around, and there is a beam coming down.
You know, I don't know if you've ever been to Assisi in Italy, but, that's what happened to Francis, St. Francis. It's just, it's this weird flaming creature showed up in the sky and beamed into him and, into his feet and hands and actually pierced him. And that became the stigmata, but those were essentially laser beams coming out of the sky at him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's a spiritual event that has very profound physical effects.
Exactly, yeah. So
in this case, the guy was bleeding.
Mm-hmm. Which is quite physical. I mean, that's as physical as it gets, isn't it? Now, switching gears a little bit, there is a dispute, it seems to be, between you and Whitley on just about how physical this really is. And I mean, Whitley, if you look at what this guy experienced and, this encounter with those people that put this thing in his ear, and there is a thing in his ear that is moving. I mean, oh my God. Anyway, really, this is hard to bear, I think. And but can you touch a little bit on that? There seems to be
the implant is, we write a lot about the implant in the book, and for Whitley, this is the key, one of the keys to the whole thing. And it, certainly in his experience, these were human beings who broke into his house and got through his security system and basically wrestled him to the bed and inserted this implant in his ear forcibly. I'm certainly not denying the physical nature of the implant or that he has one in his ear. I was simply observing that story, it doesn't, there are aspects of the story that lead one to think it might not have been as simple as that. For example, how they disengaged his security system with this magnetic field, for example. So I'm certainly not denying his memory or even denying that it was this physical experience or even denying that there might have been human beings in the room doing this to him. I was just expressing suspicion that it might have been something else. that might have been a kind of visionary experience with the human beings in the room. And I was pointing out that in the literature on shamanism, that shamans often get crystals or special rocks inserted into their bodies by gods or by otherworldly beings, and that this is what, in fact, marks them as a shaman or as sacred, is this object implanted in their body. And so I just suggest that, you know, one way to look at Whitley's implant is to see it as a shamanic crystal or rock that's been implanted into him by essentially super beings. But I don't know. I mean, you know, when I'm writing about the implant, I hope you gathered there's a great deal of hesitation on my part. I don't claim to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But it clearly violates any simplistic notion we have of something just spiritual or subjective happening.
I mean, Whitley has quite negative experiences also. And
yeah.
Couldn't that be connected to him actually refusing all of this? I mean, he is thrown into this kicking and screaming. So it's maybe like like an LSD trip that you try to fight off, which allegedly is not a good idea because then it turns into a horror trip. Maybe that's what's happening, you know?
Maybe. I can tell you with great certainty that the implant today is very much part of Whitley's identity, and it's very, very important to him, and it's very positive.
So he doesn't try to get rid of it anymore?
No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No. And Whitley will be the first one to tell you about all of the experiences of terror or horror or negativity that he went through with these visitors. But he will also insist that that was part of the training, and that I don't think at the end of the day the visitors, as he calls them, are negative or sinister. Quite the contrary. They're teachers, and they're an intimate, positive part of his being now. So there's a lot of horror and a lot of terror in the story, but, you know, it seems to be wrapped up in a larger project that is ultimately positive.
One would surely hope so, yeah. Because this is big anyway, so if it's not positive, then that's bad. So,
yeah, I don't... I've spent quite a bit of time with Willie. I do not get the impression that this is bad. I get the impression that this is really, really big, this is really, really important, and that it can't be slotted into any kind of simple moralistic categories of, our kind of typical things, that it's bigger than that, you know.
Yeah. Whitley and Anne also think that science can solve the question about UFOs finally and abductions and everything. You're also rather skeptical about that, and you think that the humanities might be more fitted. But you also say that in the end you're probably both wrong. But science, you know, we already touched on this at the beginning. But.
Yeah, I would say if I have any real difference with Whitley, it's with the science issue. He has a lot more faith in science as a method for this particular phenomena that I do. I think science is great. I love science. I love technology. But there are some questions that are simply not scientific questions.
Yeah.
And by that I mean they cannot be solved with the scientific method. And I think this is one of them. I think the UFO phenomena is at the end of the day a spiritual question about the nature of the human soul, and that science is simply ill-equipped to answer it, because science works with objects, and the soul is not an object, it's a subject. And that's really as simple as it gets for me. I just think that we're much more likely to find some answers to this question by focusing on subjectivity, and and the nature of the psyche or soul than approaching this as an object that we kind of manipulate in a laboratory and measure and replicate.
And I know that's not
satisfying to people. Yeah. But I think that's because of the myth we live in, which is that science is the only way to know anything, and that science is going to solve every problem for us. You know, that's the Star Trek myth. It's going to solve every problem in a 60-minute episode, and it won't. It just won't.
I mean, I've been following Whitley Strieber since decades now. I mean, I've first heard him, of course, on Art Bell's show. I think The Key is an absolutely astonishing book, by the way, and you reference it also in Mutants and Mystics. It was one of the strangest books I ever read. But I was always puzzled by his focus on science and his trust in science, which he, by the way, shares with Art Bell to a wide degree. But yeah, I agree. I don't know anything, but I don't think this can solve it at the end.
And what I meant, but I invoked the humanities not because I think they have the answers here either. Or they have their own blindnesses, but you know, at least in the humanities, we can focus on subjectivity and experience and the nature of self or Geist, so. I think that, in many ways, gets us further, but I don't think that'll get us there either, because at the end of the day, I think what we're talking about when we talk about the paranormal is something that's both subjective and objective at the same time, and we just don't have a way of even talking about that.
Yeah.
We're sort of hamstrung. We're just kind of dumb there.
Yeah, I think language is not there yet, and I mean, science is a wonderful tool. I mean, we would have that conversation, obviously, but it deals with certain things, and it just doesn't deal with other things. Period.
Right, and it won't. You know, and it, again, as I said earlier, science works because of what it won't look at. It gets to control what's on the table.
Yeah, that was the whole idea of the Enlightenment. Let's leave away all those angels and demons and let's focus on the nuts and bolts for a moment, and it worked. I mean, it was a great success.
Works great.
It still works,
but it's not going to get you to an understanding of the UFO phenomena.
One other thing that you point out in the book, and that really really blew me away, is I couldn't agree more, is your view on materialism. I mean, that all of this is just random and has no direction, and it's just, it's by pure chance suddenly life appears, and we don't know what life is, but how should we? We only study dead tissue trying to understand life, and it just, yeah. So the question you ask, how can someone voluntarily live in such a story? And I agree, I have no idea.
I don't either. I think we live schizophrenically. We just assume materialism is true, and yet, you know, we go home and love our loved ones and raise children and read literature and enjoy film and do all these things that really have absolutely no explanation in a materialistic framework.
Exactly, yes.
We just sort of pretend it works, but it doesn't work at all. It's funny.
It's half of the story, as you also say.
Yeah,
I agree. It's half of the story, yeah.
I think what I say in the book is materialism isn't wrong. It's just half right.
Yes, it's half right. And then there is the other half. That's what we try to talk about right now. This thing that people encounter, that Whitley encounters, one theory or one way to look at it, which also I think is very fascinating, and you discuss in your book, in The Supernatural, is it's a communion with the evolutionary impulse.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm sort of channeling Henri Bergson there, who wrote about the élan vital. But Willy himself often speculates that what he was engaging was this evolutionary force or this evolutionary impulse that, when it engages a human being, of course, engages the human imagination and so appears to us as an alien or a visitor or some god or something. But in fact, it's life itself that is engaging us and activating our imaginations to see it in a particular way. So I think it's Whitley's way of, you know, reading his own experiences. And I'm actually very drawn to that explanation. I couldn't tell you if it's the right one, but it certainly works for me. It certainly fits into my own, you know, developing worldview.
Yeah, I think Whitley brought this up, you're right. And it's the first time I heard this idea, I have to say, that this is evolution itself encountering us in a direct way, and it's a great idea. It's fascinating. It's spun in my head ever since I've read it.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, this would explain why there's so much sex in abduction accounts, too, because, you know, if evolution is really kinky, it needs sex to do what it does. And people often talk about evolution as just some kind of abstraction, but really it's all about procreating a lot. And so you would expect to see sexual elements. If you were encountering an evolutionary force, you would expect it to affect your sexual system. And, of course, this is what you see in the abduction accounts.
But sexuality itself might be something much bigger than we think it is. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's big,
no,
all right, but...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I spent half my professional life writing about erotic, mystical literature, and the bottom line was there is sex is not sex. Sex isn't what you think it is. It has all these biological functions, absolutely, but it's way more than that, and it can be transformed into art and literature and religion and God and everything else. It's the life force.
It's driving everything. I mean, and I don't know. I kind of expected to be discussed a bit more in the book, but it I don't remember if it really came up. The myth of Lilith.
No, it didn't. We didn't write about that.
Yeah, but
that's a whole nother direction.
Yeah, I did a show on this. Earlier this year, and it was the first time I really read a bit more about Lilith, and it's so interesting because here is this demon, or however you would describe her, and it does exactly those things that people encounter in abduction phenomenon. For example, I mean, people wake up at night and there is this succubus sitting on them, having sex with them, and then there are all those stories that then those aliens, they are breeding humans and so on, and there are those stories about Lilith that she is breeding demons and she's stealing the semen of young men. I mean, this is all one-to-one out of abduction literature, isn't it? I mean, the parallels are so striking for me.
Yeah, and that was my point earlier, Tarek. These are really old phenomena that are getting framed a particular way in the 20th and 21st century, but have been around a long time.
Yeah, a really long time. Mm-hmm. New revelation. So is this? I mean, when I was reading channelings back in the 90s, some of them, I mean, as I said, a lot of them are trash, but some of them are absolutely fascinating. And at some point, I was like looking at them and thinking, is this kind, and I really used those words when discussing with some friends of mine, is this something like a new revelation, you know? What are your, I mean, obviously, I mean, you study religion, so you definitely have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think new revelations are happening all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, what we call the world religions have all developed ways to shut down revelation because, you know, they don't want new revelations.
They don't want any
new ones.
Any new ones. They don't want, yeah.
No, because then those would compete with the older ones.
They don't want competition.
New revelations almost always supersede the older ones. So, but that's what the history of religions is. It's just a long history of one revelation superseding a former one. And but it's also a history of people knocking down revelations and trying to control them. And but I think all of this is essentially revelatory. And, you know, the question is always, well, what's going to survive and what's going to pass on and what's going to be forgotten or what's going to be suppressed?
Yeah. That's, I would like to touch on that by the end of the show. But before that, coming back to Whitley and his experiences, which some of them were really negative, of course, as we also said, and this went on for all of his life. And one of the things that I don't remember ever that he talked about it in any interview I heard or so, and I also haven't read it really, is this episode where he was captured, or he was taken to Randolph Air Force Base, at least he thinks it was Randolph Air Force Base, and he was locked up in a dark space or box with other children, and they were experimented on in some weird way. I mean, this was the experiment. They were kind of frightened, and he thinks that it was to crack the cosmic egg, which is another very strong picture, I think, and very interesting. I mean, you might have noticed there is an egg as a symbol of my website, so that jumped out on me. But this experience, 7-year-old child taken to an Air Force base, and by the way, I had a whistleblower on, self-proclaimed whistleblower, whom I called Jack in the interview, and he described the same thing. He was taken to an underground base with the age of 7 and then again with 14. Interestingly enough, these are all ages, or 14 at least, adolescents. But he was taken there and also experimented on. He told me that he was... an alien was sitting behind the wall, and he was put in this room, and then he vomited, and he failed the test, so to say. But it was in the same age, which, and that's another thing that then struck me when I read about this experience that Whitley had. And I know this is a long question now, but I mean, this is the Air Force. What does the freaking Air Force has to do with all of this?
Well, the answer is we don't know. I mean, you know, so Whitley comes from a military family. His father was in the military. And San Antonio has a large Air Force base at it. And that's, you know, so Whitley's dad would have probably worked at the base, and he probably would have volunteered Whitley for this experiment, which... we don't know what it was. All Whitley knows is that, well, if I could speak for him, the best I can gather from it is that what Whitley knows is that he was taken to the Air Force Base. There was some kind of experiment. He wonders whether it was a Skinnerian box, and that his immune system collapsed because of this experiment, and he had to be hospitalized. A white blood count went way, way down, and he was very ill for months on end after this. So that's his memory. He's not specific about what happened in the experiment because he doesn't remember it. But what he thinks is that this experience somehow traumatized him as a little boy and opened him up to influences and experiences that would later manifest as these visitor events or these abduction experiences. So he draws a bright line from the early childhood trauma to the later adult abduction experiences. And in the conversation we have in the book, you know, I point out that actually a lot of people who report these kinds of experiences were traumatized in their childhood or young adult life. But this doesn't necessarily mean that the later mystical event is simply a product of the earlier abduction. It's or the earlier trauma. It's just as likely that the trauma kind of breaks us open, and that this makes us more amenable or more open to these experiences later in life. So the two are correlated, but they're not. One isn't necessarily caused by the other.
So he calls it breaking the cosmic egg. So this is an experience that he is put through to make him sensitive for this, or to open him up for it. So that's what you think, yeah.
Right. That's why I talk about trauma and transcendence in the chapters. This is how you move from trauma to transcendence.
And naturally, a lot of people would say, "Well, that's the source of all of this. It's simply trauma, and that's the way people deal with it."
Well, but again, that's a very simplistic assumption. People who have near-death experiences clearly need the trauma to have the experiences. There'd be no near-death experience without the trauma, right? I mean, that's why people almost die, is because of the trauma. But very few near-death experiencers would say that the light they saw or the messages they received is simply a product of the trauma. They would say that the trauma was essentially release their soul or open them up to these other kinds of capacities and realities. So I think that's an open philosophical question. And I think to just say, oh, it's just their way of dealing with it, I mean, that really doesn't answer anything. That doesn't explain the visionary components of the experience. It doesn't explain the physical effects of the visionary experiences. It doesn't explain anything. It's just kind of this easy, materialistic, fake answer.
The easy way out. It doesn't also explain how people have collectively the same experience.
No, it doesn't answer anything, really. It's just an easy out. It's taking it off the table.
Exactly, yeah. And that's happening practically all the time with this whole issue.
Yep.
Now, I know you're not into conspiracies, but I mean, this is really strange. Normally, I would think, I don't think that the Air Force or any official, state or anyone has any real knowledge about this, or more knowledge than scholars like you or people who engage in this all their life, like Whitley Strieber. But on the other hand, if this experience Whitley had is related to that, and if this, let's hypothesize this, was done deliberately to him to open him up to that, then they must have a lot of knowledge about this.
Yeah. When I say I don't do conspiracy, this is what I mean. I'm not denying the likelihood or real possibility that the Air Force fakes UFO stuff and uses it for their own intelligent purposes and engages in disinformation campaigns and everything else. I suspect that's all happening. But what I'm saying is, as a simple layperson without any security clearances, I have no way of judging what's going on there. I have no data. I have no access to any sources. I have nothing to say to that.
It's classified.
What?
It's classified.
Well, it's classified, but also I simply don't know. And so I'd rather stick to things that I know something about. And I also suspect that whoever knows what in the military about the UFO phenomena actually knows far less about it than someone like Whitley does, or someone like who studied it, his or her own whole life. Mm-hmm. I think the UFO phenomena is being used by the intelligence community to hide whatever it is they want to hide, and I don't have anything to do with that, and I don't. That's not my. I have no access, and I'm not even particularly interested in it, because I find it, that's kind of boring. Okay, go do that, but that's not why I'm interested in the UFO phenomenon. And I don't think at the end of the day it's about technology. And I don't think it's about national security. And I don't think it's about nation states. I think it's about the human soul. And so the military is actually the last place I would go to try to understand the UFO phenomena. And so I'm extremely suspicious of the whole UFO mythology of invading extraterrestrials, because it looks to me just like a perfect military recruiting campaign.
Did you hear of Tom DeLonge's book, Secret Machine?
Yeah, I certainly have heard of him. I have not read him.
Yeah, I read into it. It's secret, written with a K, interestingly enough. I just read like first 50, 100 pages, I don't know. You are cited like all of the time at the beginning.
I am cited?
You are cited, yes. He refers a lot to you at the beginning.
So, okay.
I don't know. I have to read the whole book once, but I'm really not sure where this is going. But he also tries to... Yeah, to marry those things a little bit, or to find out what's going on here, and but he is very much also on this conspiracy, and it seems to me, and military side of things. I mean, he's allegedly it has been proven with those leak files. He was in contact with all kind of people, and so on and so forth. It's a really strange story, but I had to laugh. I mean, he cites you a lot at the beginning of the book.
Oh, okay. I'll have to look at it.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not denying that the military isn't involved. The evidence suggests they are. But, for example, go back to the Ken Arnold story we began with. I mean, Ken Arnold and his wife, you know, spent years at the end of their life afraid of the U.S. government and reporting being threatened. So why? You know, why is that? I don't...
Exactly, yeah.
That's very puzzling to me. Mm. And I acknowledge that Whitley's early trauma was on an Air Force base and that his father was in the Air Force. And, you know, Whitley would acknowledge all of that as well. I just think, though, I think that the conspiracy theories at the end of the day are too easy. And I think it's always easy to say such and such a government or such and such an organization has some kind of secret, you know, cabal that's pulling all of the levers here. I just don't believe that. I think the phenomena is way more complex than that. I don't think that it can be manipulated that easily. I think the public mythology can be manipulated. I think movies can be manipulated. I think books can be manipulated. But I think the phenomena itself is simply not, it's not a government project, let me put it that way. Because if it were, it would have begun in the modern period, and it did not begin in the modern period. This thing's ancient. So whatever it is cannot be explained by the American government, because the American government and military are very recent. And this thing's very, very, very old.
I mean, one of the reasons why people originally thought in the 50s the government might be involved is this absolutely mysterious, another of those mysterious details, well, it's not a detail, it's quite huge also, Man in Black. Those strange people, they talk in this sing-sang voice. I mean, John Keel writes about them extensively. Jenny Randall wrote a great book about it. That was actually the first time I didn't take that seriously until I read her book. And then Carly Batrip, who are those, there are two photographers in Austria who constantly encounter those things. They had a visit by a man in black telling them, asking them to give them their photos. And it's just... And then the guy disappears into thin air while he was walking away. And I mean, but maybe that. What do you think about Man in Black? And why does this act this? What's, you know, some thoughts about it?
Again, Tark, I don't know. To be honest, I don't know. I don't know the literature on that phenomena to even speak to it.
It's part of the pop culture, though. It became a big part of it.
Yeah, it's everywhere in pop culture. Yeah. It sounds to me like folklore. And by folklore, I don't mean something false. I just mean something that might have a grain of truth or experience to it, but then gets woven in a particular way and it kind of enters the public culture. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I've never had such an experience, and I have not worked on it. I haven't studied it. I really want to be clear what I know something about and what I know nothing about.
Yeah. Anyway, it's one of those details in the wastebasket that I really like.
It is. Oh, it is. Look, the more you study this thing, the weirder it gets.
Yes,
it doesn't
exactly.
become more rational or
no.
more sensible. It just gets weirder and weirder.
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, the more I read about it, the less I'm inclined to any theory. I mean, no, I'm not subscribing to any theory anymore. I'm just...
Well, good for you.
Yeah. So, as you also say, Newtons and Mystics, I'm losing the second belief system that I might have picked up along the way. And yeah, I don't think it's leading anywhere to go down any of those theories. They're not leading anywhere. They don't make sense. They explain some parts of it, but that's it then. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So coming back to, I mean, I guess how much time do you have? I forgot to ask you at the beginning of the interview when we talked.
Yeah, I think we said an hour and a half. So,
yeah, so
we've got a 2 o'clock meeting I got to get to. So I got another 5 or so minutes.
All right, then let's get back to your field of expertise. It's writing a better story, the super story
right.
that you also address in Mutants and Mystics, and trying to make sense about this phenomenon by engaging in a super story that is aware that it is a story. Your thoughts about this? So we try to outline what the question is here. I mean, we just, of course, could touch very briefly on things. There are thousands of books out there. There are all of your books with these books. And then describing this phenomenon, which is so huge. I mean, it's wow. I think people don't even realize how huge this is. And religion, it was the domain of religions in the past to deal with those things, as far as I understand. They had, so to say, the say on it. They could determine what is on the table. It was somehow taken over by science. So instead of angels and demons, we now have, we then got extraterrestrials and stuff like that. That was a kind of a new story of the 20th century. What will be the story of the 21st century? What will be the religion that is coming up? That will be, or that something like religion. What story will be told, induced by this phenomena in the future? You think? To your thoughts.
Well. Yeah, so the super story, of course, is how Mutants and Mystics ends, and it's also what I'm pointing to with the supernatural. What I think is happening, Tarek, is that we're building a new set of mythologies or a new set of stories in which to live, and that the big player here is the sciences, actually. You know, most of us don't live in a world anymore in which the earth is the center of the universe and God created Adam and Eve and, you know, a few plants and animals a couple thousand years ago. We live in a universe that's about 14 billion years old and that exploded out of nothing and has been evolving on this planet into, you know, a whole host of creatures and human-like primates for about 4 billion years now. So we're living in a different story. And whatever these phenomena are about, I think they're ultimately going to shape and be shaped by that larger story that's been developing. I think this is why science fiction has been so informative, is it essentially combines these older religious instincts with these newer scientific discoveries and tries to form them into some kind of secular spirituality. So I don't, when I talk about the super story, it's not like I have one in mind and that I think it's one is going to subsume all the others. It's more that I think that what we're actually living through here is the birth of a whole new set of worlds and a whole new set of stories that actually are really different than the ones our ancestors grew up in and lived in. And I think that is difficult, but I also think that's very exciting. And I think essentially what a paranormal event or experience is us trying to get out of one story and try to tell another. I think the paranormal is ultimately about storytelling and about creating a different world to live in. And so that's what I mean when I talk about the super story. And that's what I mean by being an author of the impossible, is authorizing these worlds that seem impossible now, but which in fact are quite possible.
Freaking stories that show up on radar, and they...
Yeah, that's right. That's a good line.
Yeah, it's from your book, so it is good.
Okay. Maybe that's why I liked it.
Yeah. So, as you say, that there is this super story developing that, so to say, transcends stories. So we are, what you say is we could spiral up to the next level of stories, another kind of story.
Yeah, I think religion, as we normally understand it, is a story that doesn't realize it's a story. You know, it takes itself too seriously. And mm-hmm. I think we're moving into a different kind of storytelling in which we recognize that we're telling stories and we won't get quite so trapped.
And we won't kill anyone else who tells another story. Maybe that would be a good step forward.
Yeah. You know, and that just goes back to Whitley. You know, Whitley is a storyteller. I mean, he's a professional writer, and he clearly doesn't want this turned into another religion.
Yeah.
You know, that he just groans when he sees that happening. And I don't either. I don't want that.
Yeah. So this is something very profound. I mean, this is you make it quite you didn't tell it that way, but it's a very profound statement. We could be on at the start of telling a new type of story, a meta story, so to say, that transcends the old stories we told, that transcends the kind of religion or religious systems we were in, and that could finally lead us out of this mess we're in. And we are in a mess, period. With or without Trump. I mean, that doesn't...
Yeah, that's actually the final message of the book. Yeah. I mean, that's what we're trying to get at. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got it. You said it well.
Well. Or Arthur C. Clarke, the only way, as Arthur C. Clarke put it, I also like this quote that you put in there, the only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little way past them into the impossible.
Right.
Very nice.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, any final thoughts on your side that you want to leave my audience with, or is that pretty much?
No, Tarek, I think we just had them.
We just had it.
Think,
yes.
Okay. Yeah, those are my final thoughts. I don't think it gets any more final than that.
All right. Then let me thank you a lot for this fascinating chat we had, for the time. And I'm very much looking forward. What's your next project?
The next book comes out in November. It's called Secret Body. And it's a memoir and a manifesto, all rolled into one. And it's essentially my life story in which I summarize all the books I've written between two covers.
It's the meta book, so to say.
It's the book of all books.
It's the book.
The book of my books, not the book of all books.
Okay,
it's the book of Jeff's books. That's what it is.
Wow, I'm really looking forward to that one. Maybe we can chat again once I read it. Would be great.
Oh, let's do it. Yeah, well, of course we can. Just let me know, Tarek.
All right, I will do so. And yeah, all the best for your work and all the best for your book. I'm looking forward to read it. And yeah, have a nice day in Texas.
All right, and
all right.
Be well, all of you.
Okay.
It was nice chatting.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Crop FM. Irgendwo. Da draußen.
Ja, die Sommerpause ist vorbei. Es geht weiter. Das nächste Mal hört man Crop FM live am 1. September 2017. Da wird wieder auf Deutsch sein zum einen. Und mein Gast wird Dr. Gary Schmidt sein. Er war schon einmal zu Gast. Wir werden über Klickphänomene, sogenannte Klickphänomene sprechen. Wenn man also plötzlich etwas weiß, das man eigentlich gar nicht wissen kann. Und die Rolle der Quantenphysik, des Konzepts der Verschränkung etc. Und all dieser Dinge in der Makrowelt. Gibt viele Physiker, die sagen, nein, das hat mit der Makrowelt eigentlich gar nichts zu tun. Andere, die sagen, na, eigentlich schon. Dr. Gary Schmidt ist Psychologe und Quantenphysiker, also eine absolut faszinierende Kombination. Und er weiß also wirklich über beide Dinge sehr viel. Bin schon sehr gespannt zu hören, wie gesagt, am 1. September 2017. Bis dorthin, danke fürs Zuhören und fürs Interesse. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Macht es gut.
Get a little bit higher. I get a little bit pale. And I fall a little bit asleep there. I wake up and I'll be high again. No one cares about it. Fall a little bit deeper, and I become a little creep, and I may appear a little brighter, but I am so pale, and I say. Thank you. the city's coming back to town.